This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we're joined by Zachary Sklar, an Oscar-nominated film writer and former editor of The Nation.
Screenwriter and journalist Zachary Sklar grew up in Hollywood as a child of the blacklist. His new book, titled The Work, A Jigsaw Memoir. And then we'll also be joined by a professor who runs the Albany Law School Immigration Clinic, talking to us about the exploitation of unaccompanied minor immigrants into the United States.
It's a disgrace and a shame what big American corporations are doing to these young children.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
Screenwriter and journalist Zachary Sklar grew up in Hollywood as, in his words, a child of the blacklist. His fine book, The Work, A Jigsaw Memoir, has just been published. We will speak with him today. In the 1950s, Zach's father, George Sklar, a playwright and screenwriter, was blacklisted from the movie industry for his past membership in the Communist Party. His mother, Miriam Blecker, was a modern dancer in the Martha Graham Company and a founding director of the New Dance Group. During the McCarthy era, many of their friends were hauled in front of the House Committee on Un-American Activities, called HUAC. Several of them fled the country. Others were imprisoned. As a result, Zach grew up in an atmosphere of all-pervasive fear. Richard Nixon rode to power on fear. After he retired, a reporter asked him what his secret to political success was. He replied instantly, "It was fear, fear, and they don't teach you that in the Boy Scouts." Zach's beautiful collection of personal essays tells his story of how he overcame the fear he experienced as a child growing up in Hollywood during the blacklist years. Zachary Sklar is a writer, editor, and a teacher. A graduate of the Columbia Graduate School of Journalism, he has taught magazine writing at that institution and also has served as the executive editor of The Nation magazine. Zach Sklar edited several books about the CIA for Sheridan Square Press, including Ari Ben Menashe's Prophets of War and the New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison's best-selling On the Trail of the Assassins, which makes the case that the CIA was behind the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Zach later co-wrote with Oliver Stone the Oscar-nominated screenplay for the movie JFK. He's been a creative advisor at the Sundance Screenwriting Labs for more than two decades and currently teaches screenwriting for the Harlem Dramatic Writing Workshop in New York. Zach Sklar was a friend of our show's co-founder, Michael Ratner, and edited Michael's memoir, Moving the Bar, My Life as a Radical Lawyer. Zach Sklar, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Zach, tell us about your parents. What was it like growing up in Hollywood during the blacklist years and how you overcame the fear you grew up with?
Well, my parents were communists, like a lot of people during the Depression, the great crisis of capitalism. They joined the Communist Party in New York, and then they moved to L.A. in the 40s, and my father was a screenwriter, and they eventually left the Communist Party because my father didn't like being told by commissars what to write and what not to write. But in 1947, a freshman congressman named Richard Nixon on the House Un-American Activities Committee figured out that he could make a very big splash by accusing people in the film industry of being communists. And that made his career. And so they, HUAC had hearings, and people who were summoned, 10 of them decided to refuse to testify because they were being asked to reveal things that were protected by the First Amendment, their associations, the names of people who were in the Screenwriters Guild with them, whether they belonged to a Communist Party, which of course was at that time a perfectly legal party, did not advocate a violent overthrow of the government. It was, they were in presidential elections and so forth. And my parents were no longer members of the party, but that didn't really matter. The name of this game was get publicity for Richard Nixon and feed the anti-communist hysteria which followed World War II. Apparently, those who had recognized that World War had saved capitalism realized that they needed an enemy to keep it going. And so they found communism. And what happened was, when this committee came, if you refused to name names and admit that you were in the Communist Party, you would be blacklisted. And that's what happened to my father. He was named three times before the committee. And the committee didn't allow you to have any rebuttal. There were no, you know, rules of law that applied. And so what happened was that people who were named lost their jobs. And worse, my father's collaborator on two plays, Albert Maltz, was one of the Hollywood Ten. He was imprisoned for contempt of Congress when he refused to testify. So the result of all this was that several of my parents' friends moved to Europe to avoid the blacklist. Others were imprisoned. Others had heart attacks. And everybody lost their jobs. So the fear that was around when I was growing up was pervasive. And the other thing that was pervasive was secrecy, because of course we were told not to discuss our political beliefs with anybody in school. There was just a feeling of hysteria in the country. You know, my parents felt that they had been damaged enough. They didn't want us to jeopardize our own lives, their kids. So they told us not to sign anything, not to get involved with any political movements, not to have our photographs taken. All that was fear. And basically, I lived with that all the way up until the late 60s. Blacklist actually ended in around 1960. But my father had withdrawn during that period. He'd lost his courage. And that was the example I got. And it took me going to college at UC Santa Cruz and getting involved with the anti-war movement, which I realized was millions of people. It wasn't just a handful of screenwriters under siege, which was what the blacklist had been. It was millions of people in the streets, and I joined them. And at the same time, I was the civil rights movement was going on. Martin Luther King was killed in 1968, and I had an opportunity to go to Fuskie Island in South Carolina, which was, you know, a very small island with no bridge, populated by about 100 black people who were living in a different century. And during this time when I went there, I was exposed to tremendously courageous people who'd lived through all kinds of things during the Jim Crow years, and also to a white doctor named Dr. Donald Gatch, who testified before a congressional committee that 80% of the black kids he treated were suffering from worms and malnutrition, and they ran him out of town and brought lawsuits against him. And so, I mean, I started to get... You asked how I overcame fear, and the answer is, every time I was afraid, I realized that's exactly what I should try to resist and go for it. And that's what I did when I went to the anti-war movement, and when I went to Fuskie Island, and when I saw the example of these people who had stood up and resisted. And that was so different from the example I'd had from my parents during the blacklist years.
Mm-hmm. Exec Sklar, Jim Lafferty here, and I'm mostly finished now with your wonderful book, titled, by the way, The Work, A Jigsaw Memoir. I'm thinking of your chapter in the book, in which you talk about Attorney Bill Schapp, the National Lawyers Guild member, whom we interviewed, frankly, on this show before, and his companion, Ellen Ray. Remind us of who those two people are, and what was your relationship with them, and what kind of work did you do with them?
Well, Bill Schapp, I used to edit a magazine called The Juris Doctor, which was a magazine for young lawyers. This was back in the 1970s. And Bill Schapp was, at that time, the editor of the Military Law Reporter. Bill had been doing military law during the Vietnam War, counseling you know, GIs who were resisting the war, and he'd become quite an authority on all this. So he wrote an article for Juris Doctor about military law, and I hadn't met Bill. I just corresponded with him because he was living in Washington and I was in New York. But we met later, and Bill and Ellen decided to move to New York and start a publishing house called Sheridan Square Press. It turned out that I didn't know this at the time, but Bill and Ellen were publishers of a magazine called Covert Action Information Bulletin, along with a man named Lou Wolf. And that Covert Action became a quarterly, and it actually still exists today. It's online. Lou Wolf has kept it going. But they were public enemy number one for the CIA, because the whole purpose of Covert Action Information Bulletin was to expose the nefarious activities of the CIA all over the world. And in doing so, they had figured out a way to name agents who were masquerading as embassy officials in various countries. So they named them. But of course, the way that repression works is that the law is used to silence people, just as it had been during the blacklist years. And what happened was that Congress passed the Intelligence Identities Protection Act to stop Bill and Ellen from naming those names, in which they did. They stopped doing it, so they weren't arrested. In fact, the only person ever prosecuted under that law was Scooter Libby, who was a chief of staff to Dick Cheney later in the Valerie Plame case. But the idea was that they could be silenced. But the thing is, Bill and Ellen couldn't be silenced. They were very courageous people, and they started this publishing house, and I edited four books for them. So the first of the four books that I edited for Sheridan Square Press was Ralph McGeehee's book, which was about his time in the CIA, 25 years, where he worked for the CIA in Vietnam, in Thailand, in the Philippines, and in Indonesia. They didn't let him actually mention Indonesia. That was one of the things they censored. But that was the first of the books, and the most publicized book was the book by Jim Garrison, who's the former district attorney of New Orleans, who had written a book about the Kennedy assassination. This was 25 years after, and Garrison had continued his investigation long after he'd been out of office. So Jim Garrison had written this book for a mainstream press, and then when he finished it, they rejected the book, and Jim was convinced that the CIA had intervened at the top. So through a mutual friend, Mary Howell, a National Lawyers Guild member in New Orleans, he got the book to Bill and Ellen, and they gave it to me to edit as an objective history. And I realized, although it was a very well-researched book and source-noted and all that, it wouldn't fly as a objective history, because Jim was a significant player in the whole affair. He was the only authority to bring a case in the Kennedy assassination. So I told him that, and he didn't want to have the spotlight be on him personally. But I convinced him by saying, look, if you can show people how you went from becoming from being he was hardly a radical. From being a guy who had been an officer in World War II, he'd been in the military for 23 years, he'd been a major city district attorney, he'd been in the FBI. He was not a radical by any means. And when he first heard about the Kennedy assassination, he believed the Warren Report. But then, as he looked into it, he realized that it wasn't what he thought. And so I said to him, if you can take people step by step through the evidence that convinced you that this was not a lone assassin, that the CIA was behind this, they will go with you. And he bought that, and he said, okay, I'll do it. I'll do it first person, and it won't be a who done it, it will be a why done it. And then he wrote that book, and then that book was not didn't get much attention. It basically, Garrison had been successfully censored in this country. They had done a real number on him. The CIA had put out a memo saying how you slander critics of the Warren Commission, which at the time were Mark Lane and Jim Garrison were the two most prominent. And they had, in effect, neutralized him by saying he was this gothic Southern politician, he was corrupt, he believed his lies and all this kind of thing. All the stuff that was written about him. When the book came out, it was greeted with a great silence. Nobody really paid much attention to it. But Ellen Ray met Oliver Stone in an elevator in Havana at the film festival and handed him the book and said, you should make a movie out of this book. And Oliver Stone, just to get rid of her, basically said, promised to read it. And he did read it, and he called up later, and he was on the way to Asia to film Born on the 4th of July. And he said, I want to make this movie, but I'm busy and I need, who can help me? And they said, well, Zach's been working on the book for 2 years. He knows it backwards and forwards. And so Oliver Stone hired me. I had never written a movie before, but Oliver Stone hired me over the phone, and I wrote the first draft of what became the film JFK. It went back and forth to Oliver. He was the co-writer and the director. And it went back and forth for, about a dozen drafts and, many, many interviews and a lot of work. But eventually it came out, and it became the film JFK. So that was, Bill and Ellen, were responsible for that. They were the people who were courageous enough to publish that book. And they did that throughout their lives. And my work with them, then after that, they published other books. They published a book by Eri Ben-Menashe called Prophets of War, which was, just a mind-boggling book. I edited that also. And they published Lies of Our Times, which is a magazine about the New York Times and all the errors that they would print. They were like a watchdog publication. And so they made a major contribution, I thought, to, our knowledge of what was really going on behind the scenes. They were, I would say, for that era, they were the equivalent of what Julian Assange is now. Julian Assange has exposed the CIA and all of the U.S. government machinations just because he has the ability to do that technically, because he could get it on the Internet. Bill and Ellen didn't have that ability then, but they were trying to do exactly the same thing. But again, the law is used as a tool of repression to silence those kinds of people, that kind of dissent. And that's why we have Julian Assange in prison today. Even though he publishes exactly the same thing that the New York Times publishes, their Spiegel publishes, and all these major papers that co-published with him, none of those have been prosecuted, but Julian Assange has been in prison for years now.
This is your co-host on Law and Disorder Radio, Michael Smith. I'm with my former law partner, Jim Lafferty, and we're speaking with Zachary Sklar, who has just written the wonderful memoir, The Work, a Jigsaw Memoir. Zach, I just wanted to compliment you. I've read the book. It's terrific. And I wanted to read for our listeners a couple of sentences that Oliver Stone, the multiple Oscar-winning writer-director, wrote about one of the essays. Oliver said, "The essay Bill and Ellen versus the CIA is a most moving portrait of the love affair between Bill Shapp and Ellen Ray, publishers of some of the most revolutionary books in American history about our covert operations, as told by my co-author on JFK. Zach, I wanted to ask you about your close friend Bill Rubin. He was an investigative journalist who wrote two explosive books during the 1950s, The Adams Spy Hoax, about the Rosenberg case, and The Honorable Mr. Nixon, an ironic title, about the Alger Hiss case. Alger Hiss helped found the United Nations after World War II and was its first Secretary of General. In the late 1940s, he was accused by then-freshman Congressman Richard Nixon of being a Soviet spy and was convicted of perjury in a highly publicized case that marked the beginning of the McCarthy era. Rubin was writing a new in-depth book about the Hiss case based on 200,000 FBI documents he and Hiss got under the Freedom of Information Act, and you were editing that book. But Rubin died before it could come out. Zach, can you please tell us about Alger Hiss and Bill Rubin?
Well, Alger Hiss is not remembered very well these days, but back in 1947, about the same time that the blacklist was starting because of the accusations that Richard Nixon brought to Hollywood, he also brought accusations against Alger Hiss. Alger Hiss was sort of the ultimate New Deal statesman. He'd been in the State Department for many years. After the war, he'd worked to found the United Nations. He was the president of the Carnegie Endowment for Peace. He was like a New Deal liberal, and I think the intent of Richard Nixon and the anti-communist hysteria of the time was to create an atmosphere of war, an ongoing atmosphere of war. I think that was the goal, to have an enemy that so that we could keep the capitalist economy going by with defense spending. So the way that Nixon did it is he found a character named Whitaker Chambers, who was a self-confessed perjurer, and they came up with accusations that Alger Hiss had somehow, when he was in the State Department, been a Soviet spy. And to prove this, they found some microfilm that was in a pumpkin in the farm that Whitaker Chambers had. It turned out, of course, that these microfilms showed absolutely nothing of any military or diplomatic interest. But at the time, these were all kept secret, and Nixon would have press conferences and have piles of documents in front of him, none of which anybody ever looked at, and effectively discredited Alger Hiss. And the intent was to discredit the New Deal and say the New Deal equaled liberal, and liberal equaled spy, and spy equaled traitor. And that was really the intent of it. And Hiss was tried. There was a lot of publicity, and he ultimately was not convicted of espionage. Just as, you know, this is the same thing they're doing with Julian Assange now. They accuse him of espionage when there is no espionage. It's just a way of having the law intimidate people and put them in fear. They make an example out of someone. So they did that with Alger Hiss. So this playbook of what they're doing to Julian Assange is an old playbook. And what happened was that Alger Hiss went through two trials. First one was a hung jury, and it was not about espionage. It was about perjury. Ultimately, they said he had denied that he was in the Communist Party, which I don't think he ever was. But anyway, in any event, his second trial, he was found guilty of perjury, and he actually did go to prison. So, just as Julian Assange is going to prison today, this is an old story. And a lot of the stuff that has come out in those 200,000 pages of documents that Bill Rubin and Alger Hiss sued for under the Freedom of Information Act have revealed that, well, a hoax the whole thing was, that Nixon and Whitaker Chambers had really cooked up this thing. And Bill Rubin, who had grown up with a bunch of charlatans and con men. His father was a con man, and he had been in prison himself, and he knew a lot of con men. He grew up around Damon Runyon and that group, you know, the guys and dolls kind of people. And so he knew a con man when he saw one, and he said he spotted them immediately, that Nixon and Chambers and J. Edgar Hoover, these were all con men, and they were just on a much bigger stage than Bill had grown up with his father's con men. So, but he recognized them for what they were.
Zach, you were, of course, good friends with Michael Ratner, the radical attorney who co-founded our radio show, Law and Disorder. You edited, in fact, his memoir entitled My Life as a Radical Lawyer. Please talk to us about Michael Ratner.
Well, Michael was a great man. I mean, he was a great lawyer, and he was a very important example for me. The book was actually called Moving the Bar, My Life as a Radical Lawyer, and those, you know, who are regular listeners to this program know Michael's work well. I mean, he had been raised in a Jewish family in Cleveland, a liberal family. He ended up going to Columbia University to law school, where he was radicalized during the 1968 rebellion there, and he went on to work with the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. He then worked with the Center for Constitutional Rights and became president of that organization, and brought many, many important lawsuits, particularly about what was going on in Central America in the 1980s, in Nicaragua, El Salvador, trying to stop the U.S. aggression in those places, and in Cuba, Michael Smith can certainly tell you about co-authoring his book about the murder of Che Guevara. Michael was a really important force for good in this world, and his book is well worth reading. The range of what he did is just astonishing.
Zach Sklar, you've just had published your wonderful book, The Work, A Jigsaw Memoir. Zach, is there an underlying theme in your book about Schaap and Ray and Garrison and Rubin and Stone? If there is an underlying theme, I think that would be that they were fearless people. And I wanted to ask you, how did their example affect you?
Well, having grown up during the Blacklist and really, you know, having the osmosis of fear, you know, just pervade my life, my exposure to these people really emboldened me to see that there were people out there who were not afraid to confront authority, to confront power, and did it with great humor and fun, and were able to live their lives and not live in fear. That was eye-opening for me, and also it changed my life. I mean, it really, I was able to work with these people, and they gave me strength. I did what I could with them. And also, one of the other people in there should be Dr. Gatch, who I watched when I was very young when I was on Dufusky Island. But all those people, Bill Schaap, Ellen Ray, Jim Garrison, Bill Rubin, Oliver Stone, they're all courageous people. And I think when you feel isolated, as my parents did during the Blacklist, you lose your courage. And I think when you are around people who are courageous, it emboldens you and to do what you need to do and what you feel is the right thing to do. And that's how it affected me. They stirred my sense of outrage at what was wrong with this society, and they gave me the courage to speak out. And I think that's what we all need to do if we're going to change things.
Fear has been resurrected again today. For 4 years, Trump stoked fear of Muslims, fear of immigrants, fear of people of color. He hopes to ride back into office on the back of a campaign using fear of socialism. He's already started that. Last month, the newly elected Republican Congress, heavily influenced by Trump, spent days fashioning a House resolution condemning socialism in all its forms. Do you think that fear theme will be the theme in our country for the next period?
Well, I think fear always needs an enemy. As you pointed out in the Nixon quote at the beginning of the program, that's the basis of some of these politicians' success, is getting people to be afraid. And so they need an enemy. In this case, socialism is a tried and true enemy. They have done this since post-war World War II. They started with the anti-socialist, anti-communist theme, and they've kept it up. I mean, they've varied it a little bit by having fear of immigrants, fear of, you know, of people of color, and fear of Muslims and terrorists and so forth. But they always keep coming back to socialism, because socialism offers an alternative to a capitalist economy that's based on a constant state of war, and that's what we've been in since World War II. So I think it's very possible we'll be hearing a lot about that, and I would urge people, from my own experience, don't give in to fear. Fear is a bad way to live, and it's a bad motivation for acting in the world. You know, you should act on what you really believe and go for it, and don't let your fear dictate your life.
Absolutely, and I want to say I think that comes through in your wonderful book, Loud and Clear. And in fact, I wanted to ask you, if folks who are listening, I would encourage them to get a hold of your book, which is called The Work, A Jigsaw Memoir. But how do they go about doing that?
The best way to do it is, the book is available online. You can order through Amazon, through bookshop.org, or through Barnes & Noble. It's on demand. Or you can ask your local book store to order it through our distributor, which is Ingram. And I just wanted to say that the title, The Work, comes from an Allen Ginsberg quote, which was, well, it's from a poem called Memory Gardens. It's, it says, while I'm here, I guess I'll do the work. And what's the work? To ease the pain of living. Everything else, drunken dumb show. And so I view the work, and I interpret that to mean not just a Band-Aid or taking a placebo or a drug to ease the pain of living. I take that to mean, in a broader context, doing all we have to do to change the context and change the social norms so that people are not suffering, so that the pain of living is eased. And that's our job, and that's the work.
Thank you so much, not only for this wonderful book and for all of your work, which is beautifully chronicled in the book, but of course, on a much more modest scale, we sure as hell thank you for joining us here on Law and Disorder, too, my friend.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
The New York Times headline in its February 25th edition says it all, and I quote, "Alone and exploited, migrant children work brutal jobs across the U.S., close quote. Yes, last year, 130,000 unaccompanied minors entered the United States. And last year, the federal agency responsible for placing these children in suitable situations as their cases are processed lost track of at least 85,000 of them. But we know where all too many of them can be found. Working 10 to 12 hours a day in violation of our nation's child labor laws in the American supply chain for many major brands and retailers, retailers like Ford and General Motors, retailers like Walmart and General Mills, whose brands include Cheerios, Lucky Charms, and Nature Valley, and PepsiCo, which owns Frito-Lay and Quaker Oats. And the list goes on and on. And so underage children here in the United States and needing to earn money to send to their destitute families back home or pay off the smuggler who brought them to the United States are working under long, unsafe, and exploited conditions for some of America's largest corporations. Never mind that the federal child labor provisions authorized by the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938, also known as the child labor laws, were enacted to ensure that when minors do work, the work is safe and does not jeopardize their health, well-being, or educational opportunities, and it sets age limits for various types of work. And as we will shortly learn from our guest for this topic today, that act is being violated over and over again in 2023. 12-year-old roofers in Florida and Tennessee, underage slaughterhouse workers in Biden's home state, Delaware, and children sawing planks of wood on overnight shifts in South Dakota. The shame of this should be mind-boggling for the American people. But as we now begin interviewing today's guest, this is still the despicable reality of the lives of these minors now in the United States. Well, let's get to it. Our guest for this topic is Professor Sarah Rogerson, the director. She is of the Justice Center at Albany Law School, where she is also the faculty director of the Immigration Law Clinic, in which students represent immigrant victims of crime. Her scholarship addresses flaws in the administration of immigration laws and policy, including intersections with domestic violence and international law. Sarah Rogerson, a warm, warm welcome to Law and Disorder Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Unaccompanied immigrant children here in the United States are supposedly entitled to what is called special immigrant juvenile status and additional trafficking protections. But you've said that they must jump through hoops to get that kind of protection. Talk to us a bit about this.
Sure. So these were protections that were enacted, I guess I can say, early in this century now, but they came through the need to protect trafficking victims and really came from normative standpoint, this idea that unaccompanied minors are often subjected to human trafficking when they cross, make border crossings alone or go to a country where they don't have adults in charge of them while they're making their voyage. And I should say children and young adults, because under immigration law, the definition of a child is anyone under the age of 21 who is unmarried. So sometimes we have, you know, applicants who are between the ages of 18 and 21 also making this trip who qualify for this status. But it's rooted in this idea of protection of trafficking victims. There are a bunch of problems with it that have been well documented in the legal literature, but I'll highlight a few. One big problem is that it requires cooperation with state authorities, and that being the state family courts, to make a determination that it is not in the best interest of this child to be reunited with one or both parents, or that they can't be reunited with one or both parents due to abandonment, abuse, or neglect. And death, in New York State anyway, constitutes abandonment for the purpose of that law. So if your parents have died, that qualifies you for this status if you make the journey to the United States to try to survive. But often these folks have a relative in the United States. Maybe they have status, maybe they don't. An aunt or an uncle or someone else in their extended family who can look after them. And often that person is appointed to be a guardian in the state family court. But that's a whole process. And in some state courts, these young people age out of that process at the age of 18. So although they might qualify under immigration law at the age of 19, they can't get that predicate order if they've aged out of the state court system. So that's one big problem. The other big problem is that our family court system is a mess in lots of different ways. And so sometimes this process doesn't go the way that it should. Sometimes it depends judge by judge in the family court whether or not you'll be successful on this application. And without it, without that state court order, you cannot apply for the visa. So once they go through the family court process, they also have the immigration process. And if they are being actively removed from the United States, it's a different process than if they have entered and have not been detected by immigration authorities and are bringing themselves forward to seek protection. It's another separate involved process with the immigration authorities to try to get this visa through. And similarly, you know, under the Trump administration, we had a really terrifying moment where the Trump administration was interpreting New York law differently than New York judges were interpreting New York law. And the federal government sent us a notice of intent to deny about 35 to 40 of these kids' cases because they were reading the law differently than the state of New York. And that was political and targeted. But of all of the different vulnerable populations to target, it was particularly heinous that the Trump administration was going after unaccompanied kids. So we fought that, and we worked with others in New York State to fight that, and ultimately those cases were approved. But, you know, we're talking about a 3-5 year process in some of these cases. And that's assuming that these children find access to resources to tell them it exists in the first place. It's not like an unaccompanied minor whose last living relative passed away or who just lost a parent and has made this difficult journey to the United States is doing so because they know they can get protection. They're coming because they don't have another place to go. I've been working on these cases for years and years and years. The law was passed when I was a young civil rights attorney working in an immigration nonprofit in Dallas, Texas under the Bush administration. I have lots of vivid recollections of these cases and these stories that are often hard to put down. It's not a free pass by any stretch of the imagination.
This is Michael Smith. I'm with my co-host and former law partner, Jim Lafferty, on Law and Disorder Show here. We're speaking with Professor Sarah Rogerson, who's an immigration law professor and expert. Sarah, it's hard to believe that the companies supplying products for some of this country's largest corporations like Ford or General Motors or Walmart, that they don't realize that they're taking advantage of these children who are unaccompanied, these underage children, and they're thereby violating the law. And what about the giant corporations that they supply products for? In short, do these suppliers not know their suppliers are exploiting child labor in the making of these products? And by the way, a follow-up, is it simply the case that child labor laws in our country are unpoliced, thereby allowing these supply companies to violate the law with little fear of detection?
Yeah, there are so many unanswered questions in those questions, right? It's very frustrating to have to continuously look at corporate oversight when we do have such what are supposed to be strong protections in the United States as compared to other countries, and certainly as compared to the countries from which these children are coming. So, you know, one problem is, from the children's perspective, working at a tender age may not be a foreign concept to them. That might be actually normatively pretty standard in the country from which they are coming. It might not be, but in some cases it is. And so they're, in effect, thinking that they're just sort of doing what they're supposed to do to take care of their family, right? And certainly that can be the case more predominantly in agricultural settings, right? I'm here in upstate New York. I teach at Albany Law School. We have a lot of dairy farms. We have a lot of orchards. We have a lot of vineyards. And that's often the place where we see, typically I see the unaccompanied minors that are older, like between the ages of 16 to 21, who say, you know, like, in order to live and in order to support my family, I want to work in this job. And some of the employers provide housing. Sometimes it's substandard. We have a lot of good people in upstate New York working for farm workers' rights across the board, but including immigrant workers, and most notably our vulnerable immigrant workers of a younger age. So there are, depending on the setting, there are a lot of different things at play. But certainly, you know, the more recent stories that have come out about children working in large factories for behemoth corporations, it's deeply troubling that there aren't more controls in place, right? There are statements by corporate leaders that say things like, well, some of these kids have documents that say that they're older than they really are. But when you look at a child and you think that something might be amiss, rather than turning a blind eye and saying, well, the paper, I can copy this paper, put it in the file, and protect myself if an inspection comes around, you know, that's not good enough. These corporate practices really hurt other businesses that are lawfully employing immigrant workers generally, not children. but we have special visas for people who want to come here to work in certain industries. And that system is broken, surprise, surprise, because all of these immigration systems are broken and dated. But that system relies on employer transparency. And it's not sufficient for a major corporation to hide behind a mask of false documents or whatever a child may present in order to do what they think they have to do. And sometimes these children are paying off debts to the people that they or their family members entrusted to bring them here, right? That relationship can turn manipulative and violent very easily because of the power difference between the child and the adults. So there are so many factors at play that large corporations use all of these excuses to sort of distance themselves from responsibility. And it's on consumers and, you know, the free press that we still have in this country to expose those practices and to make and our federal government to make sure that they're taking care of these minors. Now, another big problem is that our federal government is not doing that, has not done that, and across the political spectrum has failed at caring for unaccompanied minors. This goes back to it spans the last century plus. Children make their way here, however they come, from Cuba, from Haiti, from other places that have been economically or politically fraught and dangerous for kids, sometimes explicitly dangerous for kids. And our country loses children. Our country claims to take care of them through the Department of Health and Human Services, but then fails to place them in appropriate homes or places them with people that are then exploitative. So it's a big, violent problem that unfortunately is borne by children in our country.
Oh, dear. Well, yes. And Professor Sarah Rogerson, in that New York Times article that I referenced at the start of my introduction to the topic, There are numerous examples given of underage minors working long, long hours under brutally unsafe conditions and leaving them really unable after working under such conditions to go to school or if school, leaving them falling asleep at their desk, getting sick, and so forth. Does this square with your own experience in these matters? And if it does, could you tell us about some of the cases you've come across?
Yeah, some of the cases that I've dealt with are the kids in the older age range band between 16 to 18 years old who are trying to finish school and work to support themselves or family members back home. And it's a struggle. These kids also have difficulty with any sort of like self-transportation to be able to be where they need to be at the time that they need to be there. Never mind extracurricular activities. I mean, that's just that's not even a consideration for these kids. They're usually putting in 14, 17-hour days, getting sleep where they can. And, you know, for some of them, they are doing remarkably well in school, all things considered. But for others, they simply, you know, can't prioritize school. And I know that was the case for some of the children that were highlighted in the New York Times report as well. They just end their education prematurely in order to be able to pursue their immigration status and to send money back home. These applications, I should say, sometimes you can apply for a fee waiver, but other times it can be expensive even for children to come up with some things like the photographs that they need in order to submit their application to the government. And certainly sitting with a lawyer for, you know, the hours upon hours that are required in order to do this appropriately and get to court, sometimes two different courts if you're in state court and federal court and federal immigration court, that's a lot for a young person to handle and to be able to navigate. And so it takes an emotional toll. It takes a physical toll, certainly. And I've not had this happen to any of the kids that I've represented, but you know, it can take their lives ultimately, and that's not a system that we should be supporting in any way, shape, or form. But it seems to be one of those intractable problems in U.S. immigration law, and there are many. But this one really gets the attention of folks when there is a surge of unaccompanied minors. At the last surge in 2013, 2014, that's when I founded the Immigration Law Clinic at Albany Law School in order to help some of these kids that were coming into our region. But it's frustrating to see the pattern continue and to be exacerbated by multinational corporations that are profiting off of these children.
We're talking with immigration law professor Sarah Rogerson. Sarah, with respect to virtually all aspects of how the government of the United States has been responding to the admittedly huge flow of immigrants at our southern border, including unaccompanied minors, the claim is often heard that there are simply not enough federal employees and judges available to more quickly and properly process these people through the system, and that's why so many of the unaccompanied children are essentially lost in the system. In your opinion, is this the main or only reason why there's a massive exploitation of underage immigrant children working in violation of the child labor laws? Is this mainly a personnel shortage?
Absolutely not. So one thing to know is that could be remedied easily in the budget process. It would not even be a stretch with existing resources to send more qualified judges to immigration officers to the border when surges occur. It's not politically popular, right? Because what people like to see is border enforcement, not border fluidity. But what is happening is border fluidity, whether people want to admit it or not. It will always happen because people move. That is a fact of being a human in the world, right? You know, in 50 years, in 100 years, it's quite possible that certain stretches along the U.S.-Mexico border might be completely uninhabitable. So then what's the conversation about these horrible laws that we have in place that are largely rooted in racism? Okay, so the first immigration laws on the books in the United States explicitly excluded Chinese. The statute was called the Chinese Exclusion Act. So there's no question about the basis of our immigration system being rooted in xenophobia and racism. And it hasn't gotten much better since then. But then with unaccompanied children, this also dates back to World War II, where one of the first executive actions ever taken by a president was after the war, not before, because before the war, there were groups that were advocating to bring Jewish children to the United States to avoid their inevitable fate. We knew we couldn't do much to save their parents, but we were hoping to be able to save some children. And there were women and others who organized to provide testimony to Congress to say, these children will never assimilate in this country because they're Jewish, was the subtext. And some of it was explicit. It's wild reading the congressional testimony notes from that time. Because these mothers actively lobbied Congress to ban children from coming over. We know what happened. Thousands and thousands and hundreds of thousands of children perished. And it was after that that we had our first presidential executive action to say, all right, I don't care if Congress isn't going to move on this. I'm bringing children over. This is a humanitarian crisis. This is unprecedented. We have to do this, right? But that's how bad it is. if those are our starting points in the United States with respect to unaccompanied minors, like, it's hard to build from there. We haven't in the last century at all. There are stronger child labor laws in the United States, right? And that's been an improvement, but they haven't been nuanced enough to capture this group of kids. And we know that they're coming. We know what these patterns are at the border. They are predictable, often, usually. The additional problem with the Trump administration putting actively restrictionist policies in place, effectively closing the border and eviscerating asylum and refugee law, scoops up these special immigrant juveniles in the whole process as well. So Title 42, something called the MPP, the Migrant Protection Protocols, which never protected anyone. The effect of all of that was to have huge refugee camps at the southern border throughout the latter part of the Trump administration, which fueled cartels, the human trafficking crisis, and everything else. Not to be a complete pessimist, but if you layer on top of that the complete disinformation machine that constantly churns out lies, saying that migrants who cross at irregular points of entry are fueling a fentanyl crisis, which is just blatantly false, because the fentanyl crisis is coming through border checkpoints and large caravans driven largely by United States citizens. But, you know, you get enough of these lies out there, and normatively it becomes, I called this in one article that I wrote about unaccompanied minors, the politics of fear. It's fear-based, reactionary policies to children, and it's persistent and astonishing.
Well, Professor Sarah Rogerson, what could be done, do you think, that would ease the problem that we're facing that you've described so well today?
Well, certainly beefing up support for civil legal services for immigration attorneys. I always hate to center attorneys in this conversation as opposed to the children themselves. But without an attorney, a child is far less likely to be able to achieve status in the country, right? With all of these, two attorneys really, sometimes three, a family court lawyer, an immigration lawyer. And sometimes if they've had some sort of encounter with law enforcement, they might need a criminal lawyer just to get them out with a clean record for, you know, minor traffic violations or different things that spiral or can spiral. And in immigration law, there are lots of benign criminal allegations that can really frustrate the special immigrant juvenile process. So, you know, making sure, a lot of people don't know that in the United States, there is no guaranteed right to counsel for if you're undocumented, if you're an immigrant to this country. There's no, it's considered a civil law, and there's no right to counsel there's a right to an attorney if you can find one, but there isn't, and there's a right to speak to your attorney if you have one, but there isn't like a guarantee that you will be represented. And the government is stacked. The judiciary is not independent. The judiciary is under the attorney general, which is part of the executive branch. There is no independent federal immigration bench. So the judge is in the attorney general's office. Shorthand, it's a lot more complicated than that, but you know, in the interest of time. And the prosecutors are representing the federal government. And then there's you. And sometimes we have 3, 4, 5-year-old kids sitting in those big chairs in immigration court alone. And there are immigration judges that have gone on the record saying that they think they can walk these kids through the process. And I don't believe that to be true, being a mother of two myself. So that, you know, making sure that kids have representation is a really important piece of this. At the border, something that would, you know, lift all boats, as they say, would be to staff up the humane side of immigration, not the ICE side, right? We've got the Department of Homeland Security has one of the largest budgets of any department in the whole country. We could find a way to carve out some of that to staff up humanitarian responses.
Professor Sarah Rogerson, unfortunately, we're coming down to the end of our allotted time. We're going to have to say goodbye. But before we do that, how can our listeners learn more about your work for immigrant justice and find out about your writings?
Well, you can go to the Albany Law School website, www.albanylaw.edu, and go to my faculty page, and a lot of it's listed there. There's also a place where people can go that they wouldn't necessarily know about called SSRN, the Social Science Research Network, SSRN.com. And you can look up not just me, but lots of other different scholars' work on this really important topic. There are a lot of other law professors who are laser-focused on this issue, and you can find their writings by typing special immigrant juvenile in the search box, and you can see all of the different things that folks have written and are in the process of writing that will be published or have been published in law review articles.
Well, Professor Sarah Rogerson, we certainly thank you for joining us here on Law and Disorder to bring this really tragic story to more and more people so that perhaps there'll be more awareness of it.
Well, and thank you for the platform and for bringing this to light. I appreciate it.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.